Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In the wake of the Haiti earthquake, hundreds of doctors were rushed into the country to treat patients who had traumatic injuries.
Most of the surgeons that was there before us, they were operated, and then at 5, 6 o'clock they left. So all those patients were left alone. So when we get there, we say, no, it's not possible, we cannot do that. So we have to provide coverage 24/7.
But here's the dilemma. It's not doctors, but usually nurses who perform most direct patient care in a hospital.
I don't wanna see no doc. I need attendance from my nurse around the clock.
Nurses dispense medications, start IVs, take vital signs. Most of the medical volunteers who've landed in Haiti so far have been MDs, not RNs. We're looking for a few good nurses on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 26th, and The Takeaway for me is that if you're going to start rebuilding the medical system in Haiti, do you rebuild it to what they had before, or are you actually trying to improve it?
Well, nursing care is probably the most important sort of feature of overall medical health in a nation. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. We begin in Washington. President Obama speaking about the political minefield ahead of him.
I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president.
Telling ABC News that one day before his first State of the Union address, he's focused.
We've been so focused on just getting things done that I think that we stopped giving voice to the frustrations that people have about the process here in Washington.
Yesterday we told you about his package to help middle-class families. Today we're learning the president will ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs. He's going to call for tighter rules on Wall Street and lift the ban on gays in the military. Senate Democrats are also tackling economic issues head-on. They're now drafting an $82 billion jobs plan.
In Haiti, the United Nations says up to 1 million people need shelter, and there's an urgent need for at least 200,000 tents. In a move to show solidarity with earthquake victims, Haiti's president plans to move into a tent on the lawn of his collapsed national palace. As the aid continues to pour into Haiti, one resource that is desperately needed is nurses. Joining us now is Jeanette Sangos, a nurse practitioner. Jeanette, good morning. You went to Haiti to serve as a nurse there. Were there enough nurses when you were there?
No, there were not enough nurses. In fact, when we got there, they could not even continue doing surgery at night because there were not enough nurses to take care of the patients. And also, the night before, the patient who were in the post-op, spent the whole night without anybody caring for them. There were no nurses at all.
Okay, we're going to be talking more about that and the implications of it in just a moment with Jeanette Sangos. We'll be back with you.
In Iraq this morning, a suicide car bomber killed at least 18 and injured dozens at a strike against a forensic police station facility in Baghdad.
Here at home, the recession has taken a particularly heavy toll on young African Americans. A record one out of every five black men aged 20 to 24 are neither working nor in school. And overall, only 26% of American teenagers have jobs. That's the lowest rate in over 60 years. A big upset this morning at the Australian Open. Defending champ Rafael Nadal out in the quarterfinals because of a knee injury. Looking at the markets, futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,196, the S&P at 1,096, and the Nasdaq starts at 2,210.
What do you think the State of the Union is? Can you do it in just six words?
Ryan from Boston. Six words on the State of the Union. Everybody knows somebody out of work.
Nice, nice. You can reach us at 877-8MyTaker, posted to our website, thetakeaway.org. She'll probably have more than six words to say about the State of the Union, but Doris Kearns Goodwin, the historian, joins us later this hour.
Since the earthquake devastated much of the Haitian capital 2 weeks ago, the outpouring of support has been massive, and that includes support from the medical community. Doctors from around the world have flown into Haiti, and now there may actually be too many doctors there and not enough nurses or supplies.
There's an incredible amount of work that needs to be done, not just the medical care, but essentially building a hospital. So ranging from providing shelter and tents to getting food in, working on sanitation, communications, coordinating surgeries, getting supplies. We're building a medical institution for these people.
That was Dr. Paul Auerbach. He's a professor of surgery in the Division of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University. He spoke with our producer from Port-au-Prince yesterday. He's talking about the inherent problems involved in completely rebuilding a medical infrastructure. And we're joined again by Jeanette Sangal. She's an Haitian-American nurse practitioner who returned from Haiti on Friday. Also with us is Marianne McCune, reporter with WNYC Radio, who's been talking to medical professionals about the situation in Haiti. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jeanette, when you were there, what kind of hours were you working? How many patients did you tend to each day?
I really was working about between 16 and 18 hours, really, and sleeping about 2-3 hours, really. And the amount of patients that we were taking care of, I will say on our ward, really, we had about 70 patients who, I will say about 70 patients, it may be more, and we were really taking care of everything from OBGYN to post-op to any emergency that comes in. It was really everything.
You know, Marianne, she's talking about a shortage. She was talking about a shortage of nurses earlier, but there's a number of problems in terms of rebuilding and in some times completely building the medical infrastructure in Haiti. Here's one of the doctors you interviewed at the Kingsbrook Jewish Medical Center in Brooklyn.
We now have pallets about 8 foot high of gauze pads and 8 foot high of masks and 8 foot high of gloves. We have a small warehouse full of all kinds of blood pressure medications. We have sterile surgical trays, sanitizers to clean those trays. We have antiseptics for the patients. We have antibiotics for the patients. And we can't get down there.
Is that a common complaint, that there are supplies available that they can't get them into Haiti?
Supplies and people. That was Dr. William Lois, and he was among a group of doctors who were trying desperately to get down to Haiti, trying to get on a military flight or some flight, and they ended up giving up and going through the Dominican Republic. But so single-minded about getting there that they're, on their BlackBerries nonstop. And one of the reasons they felt it was so important that they get there is they speak Creole. They have experience. They're part of two overlapping groups that both have experience, years of experience working in Haiti. So they have the language there. They felt that they could do a great job. They know the General Hospital, which is where they ended up going to work. And
were they sending nurses? Or just
they
doctors?
Were sending a group of all kinds of doctors.
Everything.
And that really, one of them just returned, and I spoke to him recently, and he said that that was one of the really important things. And Jeanette Sangos was with a previous group who went down.
Jeanette, what was the medical infrastructure like in Haiti before? People say where they're starting from scratch. Are they rebuilding an infrastructure that was there, or are they actually just creating something out of nothing?
I will say maybe there was a little something there, but not good enough to really receive this massive amount of traumatized patients. And that's what it was before. To start with, we didn't have almost really not much, nothing, I will say that. And it's like in the middle of a chaos, trying to construct really something so we can give as much care as possible to these patients.
Go ahead, Mary.
One of the things that Dr. Michel Charles, the doctor who just came back with that same group that Jeanette was with, he said, it's not necessarily the challenge of treating the patient or doing the right surgery. It's they got to the general hospital. They had to go with an engineer to figure out which buildings were okay to work in.
Wow.
And they made all these different units in those buildings, an ER, a pre-op, and a post-op. And he talked about one of the biggest challenges for him logistically and emotionally was that the first day they set up all these they moved all these patients inside, and then that night there was an earthquake. The big aftershock, and he arrived the next morning, and we have some tape of what happened.
We have some tape over that. So Dr. Michel Charles, you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
So when we get there, we found everybody outside because they have to move them because they didn't want to stay. You want to bring them up, they don't want to go back. That was really, really bad. We didn't know what to do. I didn't know. I didn't have a plan B. I didn't have that plan B. We didn't expect that. So you have to really see what I'm going to do.
Jeanette, we also heard reports coming out of Haiti that there's so many different independent teams working that sometimes somebody's dressings will be removed 5 times an hour because different teams of doctors will come through checking on the same patients. It sounds like there's a real lack of organization there.
Yes, I will say that. I definitely agree with that. In fact, myself, I must say on my last day in Haiti, I was able to really make some progress when it comes to that. In fact, my best day working, really, because I was able to establish chart for the patient, and establish what medication they are supposed to be they are on, and so this way, and give report really to the other team coming in, so they knew exactly what to do. That part we established that progress, and also I know the physician coming now that went on Saturday, who took after us, really, Dr. August had said to give. Stayed in Haiti to give them a report of what was going on, all the challenges that we had to deal with. So I really hope at that point now that things are in place. But we had that problem. There was not that coordination, really.
Okay, that's Jeanette Sangal. She's a nurse practitioner. She just returned from a trip to Haiti on Friday, and Marianne McCune is a reporter with WNYC Radio. And the big question here also is what happens in a few weeks when all these volunteers go home? You can read a dispatch from our an intern who's gone to Haiti to volunteer at a hospital there at thetakeaway.org. At 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the stories.
During tomorrow's State of the Union address, the president is expected to ask Congress for a spending freeze on domestic programs starting next year. The Pentagon, veterans programs, Homeland Security would all be exempt. Even as the White House is under pressure to cut the national debt, the president told ABC News he won't be raising taxes on the middle class.
I can guarantee that the worst thing we could do would be to raise taxes when the economy is still this weak.
Top Senate Democrats have drafted an $82 billion jobs plan to help small business, boost spending on road construction, and to give local governments more money to retain teachers. The plan is financed by debt and faces a tough road through Congress. That's according to the Associated Press.
An independent investigator is launching 2 probes into the government's rescue of AIG. The first will look at whether the Fed withheld documents requested during an audit. The second will look into emails from Fed attorneys telling AIG to withhold certain details of the rescue from the Securities and Exchange Commission. Young girls may learn to fear math from their teachers. A new study says young students model themselves after adults of the same sex, and female teachers who are anxious about their own math skills may be passing that fear on to their students. And it's the end of the road for the cast of Bonanza.
We chased Lady Luck till we finally struck Bonanza.
Bonanza star Pernell Roberts died yesterday of cancer at his Malibu home. He was 81, and he was the last surviving cast member. That's a
Where
look
did
at
they
some
get
of
that
the stories.
Cover?
I don't know. It's great. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up.
Too many Americans have known their own painful recessions long before any economist declared that there was a recession.
The president's new task force to help the economy.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for some news takeouts, and we'll start with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. We're also joined by New York Times finance reporter Louise Story, and Ibrahim Abdul Mateo is at the...
Mateen.
Did I say Mateo? I think you should change your name, Ibrahim. We have the whole gang at the table here. So let's start with you, Todd. President Obama is supposed to be talking today about a spending freeze for some domestic programs in his State of the Union speech. What is he going to be freezing spending on?
Well, this is a proposal to freeze spending for all discretionary spending. And in Washington, discretionary spending means the stuff you have power to change year to year. That's opposed to entitlements, Medicare and Medicaid. So the president is going to propose no increases in discretionary spending for 3 years. This does not include the VA, which is like veterans' health benefits. It doesn't include Homeland Security, and it does not include defense. The real question is how much of an impact this is really going to make, because the real money in our long-term deficits, the hundreds of billions into the trillions, is really in Medicare and Medicaid, defense, and Social Security. So how much of an impact this makes beyond savvy politics, I think, is an open question.
Okay, and speaking of politics, in the same line, the Senate is talking about responsible fiscal action, and they're creating a yet another commission, but this one is going to look into being responsible fiscally.
Well, they're talking about creating another commission, and commissions sort of make your eyes glaze over, and I understand that. But this one, if they passed it, would be pretty serious. They would appoint a big commission of experts who would make decisions about how to improve the long-term deficit situation of the country. But you wouldn't be able to just ignore it. Congress would have to vote on these recommendations, up or down, no filibusters. They would have to vote on them, and they'd be forced to. The problem is that Congress doesn't like to give up its constitutional right to make these decisions.
Even to a commission? What about a blue ribbon panel?
Well, if it had two blue ribbons and a gold one, they might consider it. You know, they did one commission.
It was
on one commission on base closures did work. It's the only one in Washington that people really think worked.
Yeah,
this one's probably not going to pass. A lot of liberals don't like it because they think it's going to wind up cutting programs that lower income folks really rely on. And a lot of the old school senators like Robert Byrd, they just don't want to give up Congress's authority here.
Right.
It probably won't pass.
Of course.
Well, Louise, what do you think of this idea of a spending freeze? Is it fiscally responsible? Does it actually affect the economy in some simple way?
Well, I mean, the administration is in somewhat of a bind because we do have these rocket deficits. A lot of people on Wall Street are concerned about them. But at the same time, he needs to do programs that are going to help the middle class, that are going to help people, and that requires some sort of spending.
And that's really the contradiction here. Listen to the president yesterday.
We're going to keep fighting to rebuild our economy so that hard work is once again rewarded, wages and incomes are once again rising, and the middle class is once again growing.
The president announcing a middle class task force, from commissions to task forces. First of all, what does a task force do for the middle class, and how can Washington fight for jobs in a tangible way?
So this middle-class task force was established a year ago. It's led by the Vice President, Joe Biden. They'll put out their first report in a month. But they went on yesterday with President Obama at their side and announced four key plans they want to do to help the middle class. These programs center on child care, doubling the child care tax credit. They have initiatives to help people save for retirement, capping the annual payments for student loans, $1 billion towards that. And helping for health care for the elderly. So these are areas that are very popular and important and needed for the middle class. But overall, the total spending when this elderly program was like $100 million.
That's tiny.
It's very modest. I thought something Obama said was very interesting, and it spoke to me about the anger that there is over his help for Wall Street, because he said the way that he measures progress is, quote, not how the markets are doing, but how American people are doing. So it really sounded to me like he is trying to shift his emphasis and tell people that he's not just watching the markets, he's watching American people. And,
spending freeze for the markets and task forces for the middle class.
It's all about the middle class, you know, and of course with the State of the Union tomorrow, it's very much on his mind.
Thank you, Louise and Todd.
Let's go now to Australia with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We're going to talk about one of the favorites, Rafael Nadal, bowed out of the Australian Open. He suffered a knee injury in the quarterfinal. Is his tennis career over?
So it was ouch for the Australian Open, because not only did Rafael Nadal, his knee, he has tendonitis in his knee, and he hasn't been playing top-ranked tennis lately because of his reoccurring knee injury. But also Andy Roddick had to step out, and he lost in five sets, but he had to step out because of his shoulder injury. So, you know, this is the time in tennis where people are nursing their injuries. But there is some concern about Rafael Nadal. He's 24 years old. He could potentially make a robust comeback, but he has to figure out some way to manage this knee injury. And he's like one of these guys that athletically, he just grew so big. Maybe, you know, he needs to take a little bit of a break and then step back into the game.
Are you saying he needs to lose weight?
Maybe just he might have grown too quickly, and I think
his style of play also.
And it's also he plays very
aggressive.
Aggressive
style. Yeah.
He is extremely aggressive. He has a quick lateral movements, but also intense forward movements. He's probably one of the most aggressive tennis players.
He lunges on the court,
without a doubt.
Yeah, he lunges into the stands when he wins too. Have you seen?
Oh yeah, that's true. I didn't even think about that. Right. That may have affected his knee. We're also going to talk about a woman, Kelly Kulick. The first woman to win a professional PBA tournament. There's a 52 years in the coming.
PBA? What's that?
So PBA is the Professional Bowls Association. Oh. And I love this story because she's the same age as me. And she broke a long-standing barrier in winning one of the major events in the Professional Bowls Association called the Tournament of Champions. So now she wins $40,000. She's from Union, New Jersey. And she's assured a spot in the PBA's tour event starting field for the next 2 years. So she's put herself right into the thick of it, and this happened on ESPN. So now everyone around the country saw a barrier break in professional bowling.
Okay, thanks. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, also Louise Story and Todd Zwillick down in Washington. Coming up...
I can't think of anything more devastating to the public interest.
He's talking about the Supreme Court's decision on campaign finance rules and how foreign corporations might be able to influence American elections. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
Coming up, the Supreme Court removed a lot of limits of corporate spending and political campaigns. What influence are corporations now going to have, and who's going to be watching the store? More on that in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. One day before his first State of the Union address, President Obama is sounding like James, it's the economy, stupid Carville.
We're going to keep fighting to rebuild our economy so that hard work is once again rewarded, wages and incomes are once again rising, and the middle class is once again growing.
Focusing on the economy, we're learning the president will ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs, as well as call for tighter rules on Wall Street. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Jason Johnson, a political science professor in Northeast Ohio, who told us the people in his state like what they're hearing about the spending freeze, but it's of little consolation to those without jobs.
The independents who are at home because they haven't found work, they don't care about a freeze in funding. They just want to find out when the jobs are going to be available, if they're going to lose their unemployment benefits. They want to find out if spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week looking for a job is actually going to result in something effective.
Give us your take on the State of the Union in advance of the speech tomorrow. What is the state of our union? Can you do it in just 6 words?
This is Ibrahim Baker from Massachusetts. The state of our union is to hell in a handbasket.
Optimism, pessimism, we welcome all comers, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
This morning, a parliamentary commission in France recommended that Muslim women should not be allowed to wear face-covering veils in hospitals, schools, or while taking public transportation. Anyone who does would be refused residence cards and citizenship. It's likely to become a law in a country where there are an estimated 5 million Muslims. The BBC's Hugh Schofield joined us earlier from Paris.
You know, 5 years ago, you never saw it in France. Now you do see it. And, that offends certain people, not just women, but also many people who are very attached to France and its republic. You know, it's all come together, and now there's this great pressure to do something.
There's a chance that France's High Court will rule the ban unconstitutional. And here at home, General Motors will announce today it plans to build electric motors for future hybrid cars and trucks. It's the first U.S. automaker to make them in-house. Let's check in on the markets. Futures are down, and Asian and European markets are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,196. The S&P opens at 1,096, and the NASDAQ at 2,210. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So after the Supreme Court ruled last week that corporations have the same rights as individuals under the First Amendment, it seemed a little bit like the balance of powers was little grumpy. Listen to the president talking about the judiciary.
I can't think of anything more devastating to the public interest. The last thing we need to do is hand more influence to the lobbyists in Washington or more power to the special interests to tip the outcome of elections.
The president talking about the Supreme Court ruling on elections that will affect everyone in Congress. Yes, it's a landmark ruling with lots of implications. Joining us now is Scott Thomas, former FEC, Federal Election Commission chairman, who served on the commission from 1986 to 2006. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, John.
So this is a fascinating case, and we could talk about it for a couple of hours here, but let's focus in on the issue of corporations and their giving. Does this decision, and again, it's your opinion, but still, does this decision require the FEC to look more closely at corporations and who's giving to elections, or maybe allows them to not pay so much attention anymore?
Well, I'm guessing that in some respects it will require more work by the FEC because although the decision in theory has left intact the contribution prohibition that's been in federal law, the question will move to, okay, so what is a contribution and how is a contribution really different from an independent expenditure, which the court freed corporations to make? And the toughest area will really relate to this concept of what is a coordinated communication. And for years, a coordinated communication is treated as a contribution. So that's where the real battle will lie, and lots of folks will be filing complaints saying, well, actually, there was some coordination. The corporate officials were coordinating with a candidate who was the subject of the ad. So
right, so too much.
Let
me just back up for a second. Too much contact with the actual candidate, and it becomes a coordinated direct contribution. But if there's no contact with the candidate, in a sense, there's really no limit to what the corporation can do to fund anything but the direct campaign expenditures of the individual candidate, right?
That's right. What's really been freed up is the so-called independent or uncoordinated ads.
All right. Now, I can certainly look in the mirror and tell the difference between John Hockenberry, American citizen, and General Motors, U.S. Corporation, or Xerox, U.S. Corporation. I can vote. The corporations can't vote. I have an address here in Brooklyn, New York, in the United States. Corporations can have addresses all over the world. Can foreign corporations get involved in this?
Well, in theory, the foreign national prohibition was not before the court, and in theory, the court has not addressed that. And actually, there is a small passage in the opinion where they sort of point out that they're not interpreting that particular restriction. But you're right, there is just a huge potential for confusion, if you will, because there are so many foreign-owned or foreign-controlled corporations, and the measure of whether or not the foreign national prohibition is still good law is going to be very, very difficult.
But in theory, if I work for, if I'm the CEO of I Hate America Forever, a company in Saudi Arabia, okay, that's you know, on some side street, and I set up a Gosh We Love America subsidiary in Detroit, Michigan, all right, say, I can contribute to anyone, right?
Well, again, the contribution restriction is going to be in place, but for any corporation. But for independent expenditures, yes. I mean, there's going to be this potential for domestic subsidiaries of foreign-owned or controlled companies to use this new allowance that the Supreme Court has carved out. And it's the question will be, I suppose, for the FEC, what does it mean when the statute says, well, you can only let a domestic subsidiary get involved that way if it's principally operating in the United States.
Principally operating,
yeah. That's where the battle line will be. It'll be a mess.
And the FEC is going to have to be looking at all that sort of paperwork. Here's a question from one of our listeners.
This is Al in Oklahoma City. If corporations have a right to contribute all the money they want to campaigns, particularly in the form of ads, then they should be held to citizenship regulations just like the rest of us, and they should have to declare a nation of citizenship and pay taxes to that nation.
Now, does something like this force corporations to act more like citizens in the sense that they have to declare, a vote? They do pay taxes already, but how does this change corporations at all?
Well, the corporations, when they make a political expenditure, are supposed to track that and make sure that they don't declare that as a business expense deduction when they're calculating their income taxes. So in theory, when you make a political expenditure, you're going to have to pay taxes on the revenue that was used to do that. So that's going to be in place. And for nonprofits also, there are tax provisions that in theory cause them to, in essence, have to pay taxes when they incur those kinds of expenses. But it's very complicated to track, obviously.
Well, before we go, can you envision a campaign, a time when rhetoric like the aluminum industry supports this candidate and that will be part of the language of our politics?
Well, I suppose it depends on how lax the Federal Election Commission is. If the FEC is very, very weak in terms of trying to establish rules about how to define whether a domestic corporation really should be allowed to operate on its own as if it were not a foreign controlled company, then we've got a problem.
Right.
If the FEC is tough, in theory, it won't be quite as bad, but it's still going to be very,
very tough.
Complicated.
Scott Thomas, former FEC Federal Election Commission chairman, talking about the Supreme Court decision last week.
Sarah Reeris, Seacliff, New York. Still cleaning up George Bush's mess.
Six-word State of the Union address. Barack Obama's will be longer, but you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. The pregnancy rate among teenage girls in the United States has jumped for the first time in more than a decade. That's according to a report released today by the nation's leading reproductive health think tank, the Guttmacher Institute. The pregnancy rate among 15 to 19-year-olds increased 3% between 2005 and 2006. Bill Albert joins us now. He's the chief program officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Can you put this in perspective for this? How big a jump is 3%?
Well, given that it's the first increase in the teen pregnancy rate since 1990, I think it's quite startling. And, of course, this comes on the heel of what we already knew, which is 2 years of increases in the teen birth rate. Just to put it in perspective, the pregnancy rate usually comes out later than the teen birth rate, and we've now seen increases in both. So I really think, to me, the headline from this really sobering data is that one of the nation's real shining success stories of the past two decades may be in danger of unraveling.
And that would be the cutting in these numbers. Do we have any idea what's causing it?
Well, I think there are any number of reasons. We had a great formula that was working for us in this country. Again, we saw declines in teen pregnancy in all 50 states and among all racial ethnic groups, and in every year until this most recent data since 1990. And the magic combination was less sex and more contraception. More teens were delaying sexual activity, which is positive, and more sexually active teens who were using contraception more consistently and carefully. That seems to be reversing now, unfortunately.
Were you surprised by these numbers?
Or
did you expect it?
No, we sort of expected it because, again, we had seen an increase in the teen birth rate. And as a general matter, the pregnancy rate follows the birth rate. So we weren't shocked. But I have to say that it is, even so, it's quite alarming. And we hope, to the extent that there's a silver lining here, that this does serve as sort of a wake-up call to policymakers and practitioners and parents that, you know, what goes down can go back up again, and this does deserve some real attention.
Let's take it one step further in terms of causal relationships. You say that there, you know, we're really good at reducing the amount of sex, and we're really good at upping the use of contraception. What's causing those things to change?
Well, that's really the $100,000 question here. We can only speculate, and here are some things that we hear from folks who work with teenagers on the front lines. One thing they tend to cite is that there is less concern among this generation of young people than in previous generations about STDs in general and HIV in particular. And, of course, that might have an effect on what teens are doing sexually. It's also the case that a lot of the pregnancies occur among 18 and 19-year-olds, and we just haven't done a very good job, in my view, in this country in trying to reach that age group, the older teens. I think it's also true that many young people simply are not or have not gotten enough information about contraception over the past 5-10 years.
Okay, and perhaps affected by the downturn in the economy?
Well, you know, traditionally, if you look at fertility rates as a general matter, they don't track so closely to economic rates, oddly enough. And particularly among teens, I think it's probably not a close relationship.
Great. Thanks. Bill Albert is the chief program officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. He's talking about a new report out today that shows that the pregnancy rate among 15 to 19-year-olds increased by 3% between 2005 and 2006. That's the first increase in more than a decade.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Standing by on deck is Doris Kearns Goodwin, the presidential historian, to talk about the State of the Union coming up on Wednesday this week, Barack Obama's first address to a joint session of Congress and the American people. Here's a check on leading stories at 40, coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. The president lays out his agenda tomorrow night during his State of the Union address. Plans include tighter rules for Wall Street, job creation, lifting the ban on gays in the military. More on that in just a few minutes. How about your take? What's the state of our union in six words or less?
My name is Bob from Rutherford, New Jersey. My six-word take on the state of the nation, think it's bad now, change majorities.
Give us your State of the Union address or make it your six-word response at 877-8MY-TAKE, or you can post it to thetakeaway.org. The president now says Ben Bernanke is the best guy for the job as Federal Reserve Chairman and expects him to be confirmed. This week we'll find out if the Senate agrees when they vote on whether to give him a second four-year term. Senator Richard Durbin says he should be approved.
He is battle-tested, and I think that we need his steady hand and his good mind to bring us forward out of this recession to a growing economy.
It's a bit of a squeaker. Bernanke's current term expires on Sunday.
Moving abroad, Haitian President René Préval made an urgent appeal yesterday for 200,000 tents to provide shelter for those left homeless following the massive earthquake. In solidarity with the victims, he'll move into a tent on the lawn of the collapsed National Palace in Port-au-Prince. In the past half hour in Afghanistan, NATO says a blast hit near a U.S. military base in the capital. We'll get you the latest as it becomes available. In Iraq this morning, a suicide car bomber killed at least 18 and injured dozens more in a strike against a forensic crime lab in Baghdad. Yesterday, several hotels were also hit by suicide attacks. And finally, a big upset in sports this morning. Defending champ Rafael Nadal is out of the Australian Open in the quarterfinals after retiring due to tendonitis in his knee. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
The State of the Union.
The State of our Union.
State of the Union.
My fellow Americans, the State of our Union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
Part of our coverage of the State of the Union week, the president addressing the nation on Wednesday night. Doris Kearns Goodwin, presidential historian and author of the book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, along with many other books, joins us from her home. Good morning, Doris.
Good morning, John. I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to talk to you again. First of all, how does this shape up historically as a moment? It seems to me just a few weeks ago, Barack Obama had enormous momentum. He was working with the Congress. He bet on the 60-vote majority. It led him down there in Massachusetts. Can you recall a reversal, and it seems to be a reversal, like this in the past?
Well, not in such a period of time, you know, just like weeks before the State of the Union. Although when you think about some of the other dramatic moments of difficulty for presidents, this one is much less difficult than Clinton having to go to the State of the Union, you know, almost days after he announced, "I did not have sex with that woman,"
yeah,
or having to stand up there when the impeachment trial was already underway. So, I mean, I think he still got a chance to shift the tone. And in some ways, you know, Churchill once said after he lost the election in 1945 that his wife had said to him, "Don't worry, it's a blessing in disguise." And he said, "Well, if so, the disguise is pretty well disguised."
That's great.
Maybe this Massachusetts thing will have mobilized him to really focus on whose side he's on and let the country get much simpler understanding of what he stands for.
In a sense, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the president bet on him being able to work with Congress, a bet that Lyndon Johnson made when he passed the civil rights legislation. But is the Congress of Barack Obama the same as the Congress of Lyndon Johnson, either structurally, certainly the personnel have changed?
That's a really good question, John, because I think it's true that he came in with two promises. One, that he was going to change the tone of the way the Congress and Washington works, in other words, be a more bipartisan leader. And two, he had some real substantive goals that he wanted to achieve in health care, financial reform, and job creation. And I think what the experience of the year has shown was that it wasn't able to produce the bipartisan creation. And I'm not sure that that was his fault. He certainly did go after it in those first couple months as hard as he could have. Then the time comes, you decide, if I can't get it, then I still have to go forward in a different way. And the way Lyndon Johnson finally got the Civil Rights Act through was he let a filibuster go on for 57 or 67 days before they were finally able to get cloture. You know, and it may be that that's the kind of toughness that you have to bring to bear.
Wow.
Give up on the idea that you're going to get these guys to go along, but say this is important for the country. Let everybody see those guys talking and reading phone books and not going to the bathroom in order to prevent financial reform, for example. I don't think you should do it on health care. There's not enough agreement on it. But if there's real agreement on financial reform, you present that in the State of the Union, and then you say, okay, we're going to fight for it. You filibuster. Let the country see that you're not really for changing Wall Street.
And that was even in the pre-C-SPAN era, and we should remind people that Lyndon Johnson had a generation of political favors grown up from his time in the Congress as a congressman and a senator. Barack Obama wasn't even through his first term there in the Senate. But let's talk tone for a second. Doris, listen to these three statements from Barack Obama, and let's talk for a moment. First, here's a kind of a scary remark from the president.
I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president.
And here's Barack Obama being very natural with Diane Sawyer on ABC News.
When your poll numbers drop, you're an idiot. When your poll numbers are high, you're a genius. If my poll numbers are low, then I'm cool and cerebral and cold and detached.
He also described himself as getting a bit gray in his first year. And finally, here's something that's self-deprecating, self-critical.
We've been so focused on just getting things done that I think that we stopped giving voice to the frustrations that people have about the process here in Washington.
Has Barack Obama found a tone, or does he feel a little all over the map? And I picked those clips deliberately. Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Yeah, I think this address, more than many others, tone will matter. And I think there has to be some sense that the people feel he's on their side against the special interests. I mean, the problem in going for so long for health care and the way it finally got done, to the extent that the bills were produced by each house, was that it did seem like a triumph of a lot of little special interests, even though the ultimate result is probably a good thing. So I think the key for him now, every president has to make the general people feel, I'm on your side. It doesn't mean he has to scream and yell about Wall Street, although he has to show strength on it, but it means that he has to make people remember the person who ran that won that election in 2008, where people felt, he'll be fighting for me. I think there has to be a fighting tone. I mean, usually State of the Unions are judged not so much by the performance, even though that's what we'll do the day after, or the popularity of the words, but by whether the president is able to mobilize Congress, the interest groups, and the people to fight for his goals.
Well, that takes us right into history. And resolve a mystery for me. You know, we are always told that in the first off-year election, the president loses seats in Congress. But Franklin Roosevelt, famously, in his off-year election, his first one, gained seats. And his whole approach in talking to the American people was to actually prosecute the financial leaders of the previous administration, to go after the banks, to take a hyper-populist view. Is that even open to Barack Obama?
I don't know. I mean, it took a while even for Franklin Roosevelt to be willing to take that view, because at first he too tried, despite the 100 days, which we remember, where both sides were willing to do something because the Depression was so deep. He tried in the first couple years to have business go along with him. Some of his early programs had business support, but then they didn't follow through. Finally, they started calling him a traitor to his class, and then finally he gets up and he says, I welcome their hatred.
Right.
And it's hard to imagine Obama saying that. You have to have that willingness inside, but I think he could say, if he talks about financial reform and the need to not allow the banks to do, not just punish them, and that doesn't make sense, but not allow them to do what they did to get us into this again, he's got to show that kind of willingness to say, okay, they're against me, that's fine, I'm on your side.
I'm a big fan of your books. They are big, your books. Lots of words in them.
Big sometimes.
You want to take a shot at our 6 words or less State of the Union?
Oh, God, no.
There, you heard it there. The author herself, Doris Kearns Goodwin, presidential historian. Oh, God, no. That's actually good. That's pretty good.
1,000 pages because I couldn't do the 6 words.
The author of Team of Rivals, Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, and other great books. Thank you, Doris.
What about you? Can you do it in 6 words or less? Give us your State of the Union speech at 8778MYTAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to be talking with guests like Doris Kearns Goodwin and General David Petraeus. What do you think?
Hi, this is Gretchen in Boston with my State of the Union. Extraordinary privilege and poverty,
must work harder.
And on our Facebook page, Laura writes, visionary president hamstrung by constipated Congress. There's actually medicine for that kind of thing. And Rebecca replies, I agree with Laura.
Oh, that's
so
great.
Four words.
That's four words.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
Do you agree with Laura?
Disagree, right? And while you're there, look for our continuing coverage on Haiti. We have a dispatch from Takeaway intern Eleanor Miller. She went to Haiti to volunteer at a hospital there. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.